I'm in Rotorua, a town of 70,000 people, almost in the centre of New Zealand's North Island. The town's known for its geothermal activity. In some areas, you'll notice a rotten egg smell. That's the sulphur. You do get used to it after a while, though. As you drive around, steam rises from fissures and cracks in gardens or even alongside the road.
You can see this, the steam coming up. It's got that thermal activity that produces all of that.
Sometimes it resembles a boiling kettle. Occasionally it looks like an old-fashioned train is coming.
We are probably 5.5 kilometres above a molten lava lake. Every other city, we've been told that it's around about 15 to 20 kilometres. So, yeah, we've got the thinnest crust.
That's what tour guide Mels Ngaitai told me at Te Pue, where you can watch a geyser erupt. In the mid-19th century, a well-heeled European sailed for months for an opportunity to see an incredible natural sight. Hot springs pumped water filled with minerals out of the ground. As the stream cascaded down the side of Mount Tarawea, pools and a series of steps were formed before the water reached Lake Rotamahana.
We had the most beautiful pink and white terraces. They were the eighth wonder of the world. The pink one glistened. It was beautiful pink salmon colour because it had more iron oxide. But the white one was spectacular. It spanned 2.8 hectares across the bottom. They're just made up of a silica. So they had a geyser at the top and overflowing down and forming these natural pools.
Lynn Williams works at the Buried Village, which is on the lakeside 12 kilometres away from where the terraces once were.
So you're opening up a book.
Yes.
So it looks like a sort of a solid waterfall, almost like a decorated cake, an ice cake.
Yes, it does, yeah, and they cascade into pools. So some of the pools are up to a metre deep.
The European missionaries worked with the local Maori community to create a settlement to service travellers who'd come to see the terraces.
It was called Te Wairua Village in the very early days.
And then everything changed in more or less an instant.
And so on the morning of June the 10th, 1886, they were awoken to rumbling, fireballs were coming out of the mountain. And then about 2:30, there was a huge earthquake, and that actually set the whole mountain into eruption. Ripped the mountain open, went under Lake Rotamahana where the terraces were, and what it did was it pushed all the hot magma and mud to the surface, colliding with the cold lake, and that caused a massive hydrothermal explosion that blew that lake out into a huge massive crater, and everything was completely destroyed. A huge loss of life. We had over 120 people die.
What would have happened here?
This village here got buried under about a metre and a half to 2 metres of volcanic mud and ash.
In the 1930s, a family called Smith bought the land and slowly started to dig out the buildings which had been covered.
That's the original mud.
So this was removed to reveal the buried village.
It's just a solid mass of mud.
It's like concrete.
It is like concrete.
They've
yes,
cut a cross-section to the debris so you can see how much material came down after the volcanic eruption. You can understand the comparisons to what happened in Roman times with Mount Vesuvius.
Very much like Pompeii, mud and ash and all over.
You can learn about the people who lived in this community and go inside the uncovered properties.
The mud and ash seemed to run off the Maori houses. They had a pitch roof, and they're built with the punga, the tree fern. The actual trunk of the punga is very solid. That didn't really burn, and they survived better than the European houses.
At the side of the buried village, there's a beautiful wooded walk along a fast-flowing stream, which leads onto some waterfalls.
And I'm standing now inside a wooden hut which contains a 30-foot traditional Maori canoe called a waka. Now, when they settled this area of the Lake District, they used canoes like this. They built them in sections so they could move them over land easily. And you can see the holes around the edge that were used for lashing usually 3 pieces of wood together. Traditionally, in Maori culture, there's a strong understanding of the importance of respecting watercourses and your environment. And also, there was an understanding of the special properties of herbs and plants. And it's nice as you do the river walk, you can see little signboards giving information about the various plants that grow along the route. For instance, there's a kohuhu, I think you say it like that. It's also got its name in Latin beneath, the Pittosporum tenifolium, which looks a bit like a bay leaf. It grows to about 15 metres. And Maori people used to chew the resin as a breath freshener, but also the leaves were applied to itches, eczema and other skin rashes. It was believed to be a healant.
The waterfall is definitely worth a look, and the power of the white water plunging vertically over the rock is impressive, You can feel it vibrating through the wooden handrails of the viewing point. Now, imagine you've got a boatload of European travellers coming to visit the terraces. But whilst they've been at sea, the terraces have been completely obliterated. That's where nearby Rotorua stepped in.
And so when they arrived, the sort of next step was to guide people through this geothermal valley.
Sean Marsh works at Te Pue, just outside Rotorua town centre. It's a fascinating attraction. It offers both geothermal activity viewing, but also an insight into the culture of Maori people who view this as a special place.
The proper Maori name is Te Whakareawerewatanga o Te Opetawa Wahiao.
The name, I'm pleased to say, has been shortened.
Today, affectionately referred to as Waka here in Rotorua.
That sacred Maori place is part of the Te Pue Geothermal Park. You can take a footpath for a self-guided trip around bubbling mud pools. Sean says their massive geyser is a huge draw.
It's the highest vertical eruption of any geyser in the southern hemisphere. It's 30 metre high. It's about every hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes. And that can go for anywhere from 10 to 20, 25 minutes. I've seen it go once for 4 hours, and that sort of freaked me out.
I watched it burst into life and spray water and steam upwards. It looked like a massive fire hydrant had become ruptured. We stood at a viewing overlook, watching the field of steaming, bubbling mud and water.
The bubbles are actually all of the acid gases and the steam being released from the molten lava below. So over the years, it has been given nicknames from all of our visitors. The most popular ones are porridge pot, but most popular is politician pool. It only resembles a whole lot of hot air like most of our politicians are full of.
We stopped to look at the really bright colours formed by the different minerals bubbling up through the rock.
The yellows is obviously the sulphate. With the red clay, our people learnt that by burning it, making it into a fine powder, and adding the oils from the shark's liver into it, it actually used to preserve the wood.
Visitors can also benefit from all that natural heat coming to the surface in the geothermal area.
Find a good concentration of steam coming out of the ground, pull a couple of pieces of wood over the hole, place your food in either a woven basket or a pot with a little bit of water and cover it. No Jamie Oliver needed.
Te rā plus kaingafa, and that's our steam box lunch. Usually 11 o'clock every day that tour starts. The first thing that they do is they choose their own ingredients, make up their own lunch pack. Our guys then go and put that into the natural steam vent, and it sits there cooking. Then they do that guided tour through the geothermal valley, finish up down by the geyser, and just behind the geyser there's a little steam vent. They see the reveal. We serve it in a little flax woven basket, and they literally just have a picnic overlooking the geyser. So the protein is generally chicken, and then sweet corn, kumara, which is our sweet potato, cabbage and watercress. It has a really unique tang, but it's not of sulphur.
Every day at Te Pue, there's a Maori cultural performance, mixing music and dance. The Maori Arts and Craft Institute is based on site, and you can enjoy their demonstrations in weaving and carving. There's a school here too. That centre's also connected with a project to teach traditional seafaring navigation using the stars.
Holding on to those pillars of our knowledge, and especially the navigation side of things, that's important to us because that's how we arrived here, you know, from Polynesia.
And you can visit a marae. It's a collection of buildings adorned with beautiful red-painted wooden carvings. These buildings are at the hub of life within Maori communities.
And all throughout Polynesia, this concept of marae, the place where discussions happen, meetings happen, resolution of conflict, that's what underpins that building.
Now, even though I was in New Zealand during the British Lions rugby tour, the Te Pue performance of the haka went down particularly well. Rotorua was built as a spa town, and it definitely has a grand air. There are beautiful parks surrounding impressive Elizabethan-style half-timbered buildings which hail from the Edwardian period. The former bathhouse is particularly impressive with its gables and towers. It now houses a museum. When I walked past, people were playing croquet on the lawns. The town sits at the head of a lake connected to the shopping streets by parkland. It's a great place to sit and watch the pleasure boats head out to an island in the lake or see the flying planes land or take off from the water. Rotorua's town centre is small and compact. It's basically four or five main streets of canopied shops, but there are some interesting food choices. A recently built pedestrianised area is their foodie zone.
Each street has been designed for the tourists, and we go there too. And there's 20-odd restaurants in the street of all different types of food you could ever want.
And if you're in town on a Thursday evening, they close off part of the town centre and fill it with food carts and trucks. I found a Cornish pasty store, complete with a sign reading Cornish Grandmother Approved. There's stacks to do in Rotorua. We'll check out some experiences which mix nature and the landscape with an adrenaline rush.
A long way down!
Next. This is the Great Destinations radio show. I'm in Rotorua in New Zealand. It's a medium-sized, pleasant town, and it's pretty central in the North Island. It can get quite busy.
Rotorua does have a nickname of Rota Vegas, but not in the same way as you would think of Las Vegas. So there are lots of activities here. It's definitely a tourist and a central hub in the North Island for tourism.
And there's a large choice of entertainment and attractions, and you don't normally see so many themed activities in New Zealand. Whether you fancy crazy golf, escape rooms, climbing walls, a 3D maze or a cable car ride, you'll find it all within minutes of the town centre. Many of the experiences, though, make the most of the stunning New Zealand landscape, and you can't get that anywhere else.
There's whitewater rafting down the Kaituna River, and it's also a 7-metre waterfall that you go over. It's a grade 5 river, but it is a very safe trip.
Rotorua is in New Zealand's Lake District, and the beautiful stretches of water running between the mountains offer great sightseeing, photo snapping, or water sports opportunities.
Kayaking too on the lakes. Some of the companies operate an evening trip, which includes going to see some glowworm caves.
Well, just a short drive from my guest house is the Blue Lake, and that's a couple of hundred yards from the Green Lake, and yet they're both different colours. I stayed at the Spring Waters Lodge, a beautiful guest house with 5 rooms set alongside Lake Rotorua in a small lakeside village. I was amazed to see dozens of black swans bobbing about in the water right next to the shoreline.
Don't think down here I've met a white swan. Apparently they're now a New Zealand native because they've been here for more than 100 years.
Well, Jeff and Janice really looked after me. Guests can roam freely around their large property. The rooms are all ensuite and spacious, but there's also a guest area where you can make drinks, help yourself to delicious home-baked cakes, or grab a complimentary glass of wine or beer. And there's a lavish breakfast too.
We have a beautiful garden, big rooms, big dining room and lounge.
The people that we get from Europe coming over here, they want to see nature. We've got an island in the middle of the lake called Macquarie Island. You can catch a jet boat, walk around on Macquarie Island, and the birds will actually come up to you if you're quiet enough, because they haven't had a great deal of human contact.
Just a few minutes' walk from the guest house is the deepest natural freshwater spring on the North Island of New Zealand. And it's a lovely walk getting there through the tall, densely packed redwood trees on a surface of spongy, bouncy twig branches and needles. You soon reach the wooden decking, which leads down to the spring, and you can peer into the 50-foot deep cavern. I headed to another forest on the other side of Rotorua, where the quiet birdsong is occasionally punctuated by screams and laughter. Rotorua canopy tours are 20 minutes from Springwater's Lodge and just 15 minutes from the town. Over 3 hours, visitors will cover 1.2 kilometres of forest, but you're not walking on the ground. They'll put a helmet on you and a safety harness, and then you zip line between wooden platforms high in the trees.
So they're all pretty much native to New Zealand, so you won't find these anywhere else. The majority is tower trees, and then the big ones where our platforms are based are generally rimu trees. They're a lot bigger, a lot older, they're sort of thousands of years old, and we get 23 metres up into them, into our platforms.
That's marketing manager Nikki Dent. Small groups complete the journey through the forest together. It was interesting watching the body language of our participants. Some were very much up for it and very confident.
Wait, I got a question. Too late.
Others became ashen-faced until they reached the opposite platform when their relief became palpable as they started grinning from ear to ear.
Okay. You're all good.
It's a circuit. There's 6 zip lines and 2 swing bridges, so we explore the forest from all different layers of the canopy. We fly over the top, we walk on the ground, and we sit in the sub-canopy under some of the trees as well, so they get to see sort of a little bit of everything.
You learn all about conservation efforts to remove pesky animals, which are not indigenous.
And what we're doing in this forest is trapping any introduced predators, so mammals such as possums, rats and stoats that are dangerous to our native birds. We've got a massive trapping program in this forest, and our customers learn about that on the way around.
Those mammals are recently introduced. For centuries, New Zealand birds lived without being targeted for food, and that's why they're so tame. As we stood on the platform waiting for our safety briefing, a little robin that had been watching us from a branch above flew down to eat straight out of the instructor's hand.
Do you guys want to see something cool?
Oh, yeah. Amazing, eh? Yeah.
Are there any really unusual birds that you see that live here that wouldn't necessarily live in other areas where there might be predators?
I wouldn't say unusual. We're just seeing a lot more of them. Right on cue.
We've got a visitor.
And at that point, an inquisitive, tiny little round bird, like a flying Christmas tree bauble, came and rested a couple of inches away from us. I headed across town for another forest, this time one made up of non-native trees.
The redwoods here were planted in around 1901. Originally, they were brought here in the late 1800s by the New Zealand government because they realised that New Zealand natives didn't grow quickly enough for commercial forestry.
The Redwoods Tree Walk is a half a kilometre long walkway above the forest, made up of interconnected swaying wooden bridges. They're suspended from the trees and they don't damage the trunks. I climbed up these steps to the first platform from which the walk starts. Karen Mather told me it's a circular route through the forest.
So you start at 6 metres in height and the tree walk goes on for 553 metres. So as long as you can walk half a kilometre on the ground, then you're fit enough to go up on the walk. And then the highest point on the tree walk is 12 metres, but you only have to climb up the steps at the beginning, and then after that you're on the suspended walkways and platforms. It's just one loop track, so you shouldn't get lost.
I'm walking over the bridge now, and as I stepped onto it, it moved a lot more than I thought it was going to. I'm not so great with heights.
Although you won't get the views after dark, a nighttime visit is worth it.
We offer the Redwoods nightlights in the evening. So we've got 30 David Troubridge designed lanterns on the tree walk and also 30 spotlights on the ground. So the lanterns are white LED light bulbs and then the lights on the ground are coloured lights. And you can walk around and enjoy just a completely different experience at night.
Now, for real adrenaline junkies, there's Ogo. Andrew Akers invented zorbing here in New Zealand back in the 90s. That's where you climb into a giant transparent ball and roll down a hill.
Yes, this is my baby. So initially a buddy and I sort of came up with the idea thinking we'd like to walk on water and thought a big ball would be the way to do it. So built it in the backyard and traditional sort of Kiwi style, you sort of just go out there and find some plastic and glue it together and hope that it's vaguely spherical and take it out onto the water. So that's where it came from.
Now Andrew operates an attraction called Ogo, which gives you the chance to climb into one of those plastic bubbles and zigzag down a hill, changing direction 5 times. Or you can go directly down the steep incline of 35 metres. You can do it dry, or you can have your orb filled with water, which sloshes around you as you make your descent.
It's steeper than a car would drive up. It's about 20 degrees or so in terms of the slope. But you get up a fair amount of speed. One of the things that I think people don't really realise is that the Ogo balls are massive. You know, they're 3.5 metres in diameter. So they're huge. It's like looking at an elephant when you're up close. When you're inside, it feels like it's way faster than it looks like from the outside.
If you're travelling to New Zealand, It's a big trip, and you're probably going to want to plan ahead. Rotorua is easy to get to, and it makes a good touring base. You're just 50 minutes from the beach, and because there's so much business competition around town, I found that meals are at least 10% cheaper in cafes and restaurants than in other Kiwi towns of similar size. Rotorua's range of things to do should provide enough entertainment for the most diverse group of travellers. And when you consider the beautiful lake-filled landscape, incredible geothermal sites, and rich Maori cultural experience, it takes some beating. But Rotorua originally developed around the needs of tourists, and today you'll still notice how well visitors are treated. They call it New Zealand's coolest hotspot. You're bound to experience a warm welcome. I was kindly accommodated by Jeff and Janice. You can look them up online at springwaterslodge.co.nz.
The Great Destinations Radio Show.